The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Vice President Gore believed profoundly in the rule of law, believed profoundly in the idea of our institutions, and believed profoundly that those institutions were more important than any one election and any one person.
I'm Nate Jones.
And I'm David Chris, and this is the Culper Partners Rule of Law special series on the Lawfare podcast. It's April 20, 2019.
In this special series, we explore the rule of law, particularly as it relates to U.S. national security and criminal law enforcement.
Today, we're joined by Ron Klain, former senior White House and DOJ official. Ron has served his country repeatedly, including in senior positions at the highest levels of all three branches of the government. He began his legal career as a law clerk to Justice Byron White on the Supreme Court. He was chief counsel of the Senate Judiciary Committee. He was chief of staff to Vice Presidents Joe Biden and Al Gore, and in that role also served as a senior advisor to Presidents Barack Obama and Bill Clinton. He's a veteran of Democratic Party politics. He's worked on seven presidential campaigns, including the hotly contested 2000 election between George W. Bush and then Vice President Al Gore. Today, among other things, he's an adjunct professor at both Georgetown University and Harvard Law School.
We asked Ron to join us on the podcast for two reasons. First, you cannot have a discussion about the rule of law without also talking about American democracy and the electoral process, and there is no one better positioned to address that topic than Ron. Ron takes us on a trip down memory lane to discuss the hotly contested election between then-Vice President Al Gore and President-to-be George W. Bush. In doing so, we get his perspective on why he thinks the Supreme Court's decision departed from the rule of law. Second, Ron worries that our democracy is caught in a symbiotic downward spiral together with the rule of law, from active measures being deployed by foreign adversaries to partisan political efforts to rig the system. Ron is concerned about the future.
It's the Lawfare Podcast, episode 410, Ron Klain on the rule of law.
So let's get started. The rule of law is a foundational principle that is embraced in most functioning democracies around the world. What is the relationship, in your opinion, between the health of democracy and the health of its electoral process? And what is its effect on the rule of law?
Well, look, I mean, I think the rule of law underpins and enables democratic systems to continue to function. But there's a close relationship between the two, which is that the rule of law is a concept. It's an idea. It has to be in people's heads and hearts. It has to be embraced by the key players in the system. It has to be accepted as a basic norm that both sides are going to honor. And I think what you're seeing in some parts of the world, and potentially also here in the United States, is the kind of symbiotic erosion between these two ideas. So people stretch democratic norms, stretch the rule of law, that leads them to stretch the democratic norms even more in response to that. And you kind of get this spiraling, escalating struggle between erosion in the rule of law, erosion in democratic norms, further eroding the rule of law, further eroding democratic norms. And, you know, I think that's the number one challenge we face today at a big conceptual level in our country, and one that's going to be with us for a while now, having the genie kind of having been let out of the bottle.
So when you were the Ebola response coordinator in 2015, you saw some stress on the system and misinformation, albeit in a slightly different context. How do you compare the two contexts? How did you stop the downward spiral in the context of Ebola? And how do we get out of that kind of a downward spiral?
Well, it's a great question, because I think we saw it both here in the U.S. and in West Africa separately. So let's talk about the U.S. case, right? In the United States, a person named Donald Trump, who had been a prominent kind of political agitator around alleging that President Obama had not been born in the United States, had been publicly ridiculed on that, and had kind of withdrawn from public life until the fall of 2014, when he reemerged on the national stage, spewing via his Twitter account false information and hate about the Ebola epidemic in West Africa. This really was Donald Trump's reemergence into the national scene after the birther fiasco. And what he said was that that any efforts to fight the disease in West Africa would inevitably lead to the disease coming back here to the United States, that efforts to medevac sick Americans who had been over in West Africa fighting the disease, that bringing those people back to the United States would lead to spread of the disease in the U.S. He called President Obama's decision to bring back an evangelical worker who had been fighting the disease and gotten sick, called the decision stupid. He said it was sure to be a disaster, an apocalypse. And he was wrong about all of that. And what were the consequences? The consequences were that his hatred and his falsehoods really struck public fear. It led to pressure on Congress to cut off all efforts by Americans to go fight the disease in West Africa. It led on pressure on Congress to cut off all travel back and forth between the two countries, the two regions. It led on pressure on local governments not to allow these sick people to be treated safely in the U.S. And it created an entire firestorm around Ebola that deeply impaired what we were doing. Now, how did we fight that? We fought that in two key things. The first was by having scientists go back and respond to Trump and explain why he was wrong about these things, so on and so forth. But secondly, and more importantly, by having political leadership willing to take the heat from the public and do the right thing with a science-based approach. And that really was President Obama, who took some political heat, who was dinged up in the polls because of Trump's attacks, but nonetheless insisted we were going to do the right thing to fight Ebola, saved lives, and ultimately Trump was proven wrong. We bought Dr. Craig Spencer, who's been fighting the disease in West Africa, came back, was treated in the heart of New York City at Bellevue Hospital. He was released and well, and no one who treated him got sick, and none of the people who moved him in or out of the city got sick or nothing like that, right? Trump's fears were totally misguided. This problem still lingers with us today. We see it in things like the refusal of people to get vaccines, the spreading of conspiratorial information about that, and the spreading of false information about that online. But I'd say that, to me, the big lesson from a domestic context is the only way you can stand, the only way you can stop this kind of false information, fake news, whatever you want to call it, is by having political leadership that will stand up to it, will do the right thing, will take evidence-based leadership, and then be judged by the results of that.
Based on that answer, I guess sticking with the theme of misinformation, I'll ask you a bit of a leading question here. Do you think Donald Trump, obviously people have focused quite a bit on him in this context, do you think he's a cause or a symptom of this problem, or is it a little bit of both?
Well, I think both, certainly. I mean, I think he preys on and uses systems, networks, and ideas that are out there, particularly social media as a tool for disseminating this information, and the incredible dry tinder that exists of a distrust of elites, of kind of this right-wing populist movement that's not only true here in the United States, but in Western Europe as well. And clearly, he is acting on forces that are there. But I think there's no – I think he helps create those forces in no small amount. I mean, these ideas, these kind of very flaky right-wing ideas have been out there for decades, right? I mean, all the way back to the John Birch Society in modern times and other circles. And what's happened is the combination of technology and highly visible people like Donald Trump who are willing to embrace these ideas are really what's giving them such currency and making them such a – confounding factor for our democracy.
Ron, let's talk about candidate vetting and candidate selection with that as background. Because on the one hand, it seems like candidates today are subject to ever more intensive and invasive scrutiny, and that, you know, there's a concern that maybe that's a deterrent to some people to go into politics. And on the other hand, and very much at the same time, there seems to be a countervailing trend that for certain kinds of candidates, and President Trump is probably one of them, it almost doesn't matter what the vetting produces and what information about them comes out. How do you square that circle? How do you make sense of that sort of pair of countervailing trends, and what ought we to do about it to get it back on track?
Well, I do think there's more transparency than ever in our political process around the candidates and their conduct, their behavior, whatever. We know a lot more about Donald Trump probably than we've known about any presidential candidate. And so, you know, I think that the news media does its job. I think that various organizations that do this work do their job. And I think that's a good thing, right? And I think if people are deterred by that, you know, I mean, that's too bad, but that's, I think, the right thing in a democratic society, particularly a large, diffuse democratic society. We should have information about the people who are seeking higher office, particularly the presidency. Now, how come knowing all that information didn't keep Donald Trump from becoming president? Well, I think there are two answers there. I mean, I think one is that we should never forget that, in fact, more Americans voted for his opponent than voted for Donald Trump. And look, although everyone kind of thought of this as an election that Hillary Clinton couldn't lose, in fact, the fundamental dynamics of the election really pointed towards a Republican winning. There's only really been one time since World War II where parties won three presidential elections in a row, 1980, 84, and 88. Every other time over the past 70 years, you know, we're a change-oriented country. A party wins two in a row, and then the other party comes in. So I think that a lot of the fundamentals here really did help Trump in many, many respects. And even so, he did get fewer votes. He kind of squeaked through on a quirk of the Electoral College. Okay, fine. But the second thing I'd say is that, look, people voted for Trump knowing all this stuff because the people who voted for Trump didn't care. They were voting for Trump not to make a statement about Trump, but I think in large part to make a statement about themselves. They put on the red hats. This wasn't like some secret vote they cast in embarrassment or shame. This was they were trying to make a statement about their view about the state of the country, their objection to things that most of us, particularly on the two coasts, celebrate: diversity, inclusion, progress on technology, the way in which our country is becoming part of a more global system. There are people who don't like all that. And they wanted those of us who do like all that to know that's how they felt. And so they didn't really care. Trump became a vessel for those feelings. And notwithstanding the flaws that Trump had, notwithstanding all the things they knew about Trump, they wanted to send a signal, and they sent that signal and wound up with that signal becoming president of the United States.
Do you see value in the Electoral College, or is it just inherently anti-democratic?
I don't see value in the Electoral College. Not only is it anti-democratic, it really skews the way in which we conduct elections. We're going to see this even more pointedly in 2020. As we tribalize and as the states harden into red and blue states, the number of states in play gets fewer and fewer and fewer. The electoral battleground was smaller in 2016. It had been in 2008. In 2020, it may be as few as six states. And the presidential campaign then only visits those states. They're the only people who see the candidates. They're the only people who see the ads. They're the only people who really participate in the campaign. The only thing that's anti-democratic, it really, you know, cuts a lot of people on both sides, both Democrats and Republicans, out of the presidential campaign. I don't think a presidential candidate has campaigned in the state of California after Labor Day since 1992. They're, you know, people who are going to be 30 years old, never seen a presidential candidate after Labor Day in the nation's largest state. That seems crazy to me, and that's the product of the Electoral College.
Let's talk about the role of the courts in the election process. You were deeply involved in one of the most hotly contested presidential election campaigns, which famously ended in a legal battle that was ultimately settled by the Supreme Court. 10 years after the court decided Bush v. Gore, you wrote that one point you had, quote, a horrible feeling that in the most important case in our lifetimes, the legal system was lurching toward a colossal failure. Was that a failure of the laws that were in place, or was the court, in your opinion, departing from the rule of law in its decision?
So it was both. I think that inside the state of Florida, there was a lack of an adequate set of procedures to govern the kind of post-election recount that we were trying to get done in 2000 in Florida. And by contrast, I'd point to actually what happened this year, 2018, with the recount in the Nelson race, where they had procedures that had been adopted since 2000 that allowed for an orderly statewide recount. It was conducted relatively promptly. They found a lot of errors. You know, the gap really narrowed from Scott winning by about 50,000 votes to about 10,000 votes. And there was a lot of mistakes in the system. They were found promptly. And nonetheless, in the end, though 10,000 votes was very close, Rick Scott did win and Bill Nelson lost. And even so, still a lot of problems, right? A bunch of ballots that were mailed in that were never counted, so on and so forth. But nonetheless, Florida, in the 20 years since Bush v. Gore, enacted adequate procedures to allow this process to be done in a way that was prompt, fair, and orderly. Okay. So that was missing in 2000. None of those procedures were in place. The state courts, the state administrative procedures were being made up as we went along. It's a horrible way to make law in a highly interested situation where the state's chief elections officer, the Secretary of State, was the chair of the Republican campaign in the state. That is not a way to make administrative rules or to set the backdrop for a legal dispute. That's one problem. When we got to the Supreme Court, what I'd say is the court made a decision that is still, you know, nearly 20 years later, indefensible and unsustainable. It applied the Equal Protection Clause in a way that it had never had before and never has since by ruling that the potential for minor variations in the ways in which different ballots were being treated as they were being recounted created an equal protection violation with no sense that there was any kind of animus or discrimination or bias, merely administrative choice. They ruled that that violated the Equal Protection Clause. There's never been an instance like that before. There's never been an instance like that since. Then the Supreme Court, on top of that, made a decision that was a Florida law decision that rather than ordering a new count with the right procedures, the court said that the state of Florida, if it were given the choice, would prefer to have an inaccurate total submitted on time under the Electoral College Safe Harbor Act than an accurate total submitted late. That is a decision about Florida law that should have been remanded to the Florida courts, and it was not. So I think there are two indefensible decisions made on strictly partisan grounds in the Supreme Court. The five justices appointed by Republican presidents all ruled for that kind of result in the case. The other four justices did not. And I think that's been a blot on the Supreme Court's legacy. And I think in part, it's led to a lot of the confirmation wars we've seen since then, because the court clearly communicated, intentionally or not, to the political system, to the presidents, to the senators that came after, that the partisan affiliation of justices could decide something as important as a presidential election. And as a result, we've had the most contentious confirmations consistently in American history in the 20 years since Bush v. Gore. I don't think that's unconnected. And I think it's, again, a kind of an erosion of our institutions that was set off by the court's indefensible decision in that case.
So faced with a set of laws and a judicial decision that the campaign felt was unjust, then Vice President Al Gore decided to concede the election nonetheless. And I'm wondering how that decision was made, to the extent you were privy to it. Can you walk us through what was going through the campaign's minds and maybe even the vice president's mind at the time, and, you know, considering whether to fight on, at least in the court of public opinion, was that an option that was considered? Can you talk to us a little bit about that?
Sure. So first of all, there were legal options. The morning after the Supreme Court ruled, there were some legal options, and indeed it spent all night, overnight, working on those options, preparing a filing to go back to the Florida Supreme Court to say that the U.S. Supreme Court's ruling about Florida law wasn't binding on the Florida Supreme Court, that it could determine what to do The court technically had actually remanded the case to the Florida Supreme Court for final disposition. That gave the Florida Supreme Court a jurisdictional hook to potentially dig back into this issue. And we prepared this and presented it to Vice President Gore the next morning. And he made a decision that the prospects for success were very low, that the Supreme Court was the highest court in the land, and that efforts, even though there was a legal theory to go back to the Florida Supreme Court, efforts to do that would be seen as corrosive of the court's authority. And he gave us two very clear instructions that morning. The first instruction was to cease all work and that he intended to concede and accept the court's decision as final. And the second was he instructed us not to publicly criticize the Supreme Court, not to criticize the court's ruling, not to criticize the correctness of the ruling, not to criticize its legitimacy. And then Vice President Gore addressed the country that evening and explained his decision, explained that he was not just ending the fight, but actually conceding to George Bush and lending legitimacy to his victory, even under dubious circumstances. Now, why did he do that? Vice President Gore believed profoundly in the rule of law, believed profoundly in the idea of our institutions, and believed profoundly that those institutions were more important than any one election and any one person. You know, I at the time disagreed with that decision, not so much the decision to respect the court, but I did disagree with the decision to give up on the litigation route. I think there were perfectly legitimate arguments for going back to the Florida Supreme Court. But I always respected the kind of leadership and selfless leadership and institutional leadership that Vice President Gore provided in that moment. And I think it, you know, should have, hopefully would have, set an example for others to follow.
So, Ron, you described how laws of Florida when it comes to vote counting were not sufficiently developed back then. I want to ask you a question then about what might happen today if we saw a new version of this. And it may seem like a softball, but I think it leads to something interesting. And that is, you know, given the statesmanlike behavior that you've just described from Vice President Gore, do you have any confidence that if an analogous situation arose in the next election and President Trump were the apparent loser, he would make a similar choice? And the reason I want to tee that up is sort of, do you think our system is currently equipped to accommodate a president who doesn't concede at some point?
Yeah, I mean, I think it is truly the nightmare scenario about 2020. I mean, people back in 2000 called it a constitutional crisis, but in fact, it was the Constitution playing itself out. And while I do think the Supreme Court reached an indefensible decision in 2000, and while I've never said, quote unquote, the system works, because I think it's an example of the system not working, the system held. The institutions did what they did. The institutions produced a result, and the players in the system accepted the result of the institutions, even if that result was unfair or wrong. And that's ultimately the test of a political system's resilience, is will people accept the outcome even when the outcome is incorrect or even when the institutions aren't really functioning the way they should function? And, you know, I think there's really no reason to believe that we would see a similar outcome in 2020. Not only do I think President Trump might well refuse to leave office if he loses narrowly, he might refuse to leave office if he doesn't even lose narrowly. We saw in the 2018 elections his attacks on lawful recount in Florida. When he thought that Rick Scott was going to lose the recount, he tried to delegitimize the vote counting there. His repeated attacks on the vote counting in California in close congressional races, where he said this wasn't vote counting, this was vote manufacturing. So I think we have to expect in 2020 that unless Trump loses just decisively and overwhelmingly, he will dispute the election result. And it's hard to know what will happen. I mean, in the end, we rely on the good faith of the participants in our system to make the system work. And I go back to a scenario, an obscure scenario from 2000. You know, it was always possible for the Gore team to claim in 2000 that Gore had won in Florida. There are a lot of reasons to think the outcome in Florida was really just a mess, not just the fact that some votes were never counted, but the famous butterfly ballot in Palm Beach County, the snake ballot in Duval County, so on and so forth. And we considered a plan, which we ultimately obviously rejected. We considered a plan, though, to have the Democratic electors come to the state capitol on the day prescribed by law and cast their ballots for Gore and ship those ballots to D.C., where they would go into the Congress to be resolved. And the rule for resolving electoral disputes in a presidential election is that if there's a dispute over whether or not a set up slate of electors is the right slate of electors, is properly elected, that the House and the Senate separately convene and vote. And both chambers have to vote to overturn the result. And at that time, the Republicans controlled the House. The Senate was evenly divided, would not have been able to vote to overturn the result. And you could have had a scenario where there had been an envelope of Democratic electors and an envelope of Republican electors. And whichever envelope was opened and tallied would have had the presumption of correctness. And the person who presides over that proceeding and decides which set of electors is recognized is the Vice President of the United States, is the President of the Senate. So you had a scenario where Al Gore himself could have pointed to the Democratic envelope and said, that's the default envelope. Could open that envelope, could announce that tally, and the Senate, House and Senate wouldn't be able to overturn that. And essentially, he would have made himself president. Okay, that's a constitutional crisis. That's one that Vice President Gore never considered. Never would he even give a moment's thought to something as crazy as that, notwithstanding the fact that, you know, you could spin it all out that way and has been spun out that way. But that's something you can easily see something that much more extreme Donald Trump doing. And I think that how we're going to deal with that in 2020, that is a very daunting prospect.
In fact, it seems we've actually confronted a similar, not too different from that in recent elections, and even in the 2000 election, where the chief election official in many of the states is a partisan official. And whether that person is overseeing an election is merely a member of the political party of a candidate for higher office, or as a candidate themselves for higher office, Americans have long been cognizant of the concern that partisan politics could impact the operation or even the outcome of an election, dating back to, again, the 2000 election. And for those old enough to remember, Kathleen Harris, the Secretary of State in Florida at the time, became a household name. And I'm wondering, how serious are these concerns about partisan manipulation of elections at the state or even the national level?
Well, I think they're very serious, and it's really inexcusable and unacceptable. I mean, we saw it in 2018, most notably in Georgia, where Brian Kemp right. was both the state's chief elections officer and the Republican nominee for governor in a very close race against Stacey Abrams. And he used both his control over the electoral system to advantage his campaign enormously, purging huge numbers of African-American voters off the rolls, misdeploying electoral resources so that in African-American precincts there were fewer polling places, fewer polling machines, fewer poll workers, and as a result, longer waits to vote in an effort to deter voting that way, and all kinds of other shenanigans around the administration of the election. You know, that's just kind of inexcusable, and it's been exacerbated since 2013 when the Supreme Court in Shelby County versus Holder struck down Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act, struck down preclearance of the Voting Rights Act, which would have required many electoral procedure changes to be submitted to the Justice Department before being implemented in the states covered by the Voting Rights Act, and that's really particularly in the South, turn loose all kinds of efforts by now majority white office holders to try to entrench that majority by doing a bunch of things to effectively suppress African-American votes. And so I think that's it's one of the most noxious aspects of our system right now. And, I think that and really kind of almost unique to American democracy and most other democratic countries in the world, and some kind of neutral professional authority operates the electoral system, and the electoral system management has moved out of politics into a kind of a more neutral mode. That's definitely not our situation here.
So I guess Kemp should have recused himself because he was an actual candidate. Should Harris have recused herself just based on party affiliation? Or should we really move in the direction of a whole new system for vote administration?
Yeah, I think we should. I think we should move into a system of having nonpartisan officials administer the vote, administer the design of ballots and the implementation of electoral systems. You know, look, as you said, I've worked on a lot of campaigns. I've won, I've lost. I'm always prepared to accept that. But we shouldn't have campaigns that win or lose because someone rigs the vote counting or, you know, but messes with the ways in which the system is administered to advantage one side or the other. If we really want to be a democracy, the goal should be that everyone gets to vote, who's lawfully allowed to vote gets to vote, and those votes are fully tabulated. And then whichever side wins, wins. And that should be a norm we accept. But what's happened now is that isn't the norm. And the norm right now is that it's part of the partisan political process that's got a heavy overlay of race to it to try to have Republicans win elections by narrowing the electorate and by making it hard for people to vote. And that is, you know, a very anti-democratic way to try to run a democracy.
Help us understand a little bit, or help our listeners understand sort of, you know, as these norms of sort of being pro-voting or of being a referee in your own contest start to erode, I mean, is it just short-term thinking that keeps that kind of thing going? I mean, because as the norms erode, it seems like what's going to be sauce for the goose will be sauce for the gander in the next election. Is there no sense that it's in everybody's long-term interest to maintain integrity here? Explain a little bit more about why it does seem to be eroding and we can't reverse the downward spiral with fear of the sort of, you know, treatment coming the other way in the next election.
You know, it's a great question. And, you know, I think it's probably easiest to understand, as I said, in the South polarized around race, which is that take Georgia as an example. It's a state that has never had an African-American elected statewide official. Stacey Abrams came close to becoming elected governor of Georgia past time, first African-American ever to hold such an office, first African-American woman in America to hold such an office. And so you take issues of partisanship and you add race to it and you have a toxic mix. And I think that's what we've seen in a lot of these places, which is that demographically you have non-white voters becoming a larger and larger share of the electorate, certainly non-white adults becoming a larger and larger share of the population. And when you have an alignment between a race and a political party, you have incentives, sad incentives, for the Republicans to try to limit the number of African Americans who can vote. And other people of color, Hispanic voters, also were really severely affected by the practices in Georgia. It's growing Hispanic presence there, trying to maintain political control of a dwindling majority, maintain this control by shaping and controlling the electoral process. And, you know, I think you'd think that they would understand the shoe will be on the other foot someday, but I think that a combination of short-termism and a view that once they lose control over the apparatus, they may never get it back, I think drives a lot of what we're seeing. You know, but I think over time, you know, hopefully a growing majority alienated by these practices will eventually be large enough in number to overtake the practices. But for the time being, those practices are working to maintain control of these states.
So let's go both backward and forward in time from actual vote counting, first backwards to gerrymandering. Can you explain a little bit your perspective on how that has evolved in recent times? And in particular, what do you think, if any, is the role of the courts in limiting or constraining gerrymandering as a practice going forward?
Well, you know, it's one of the tragedies, I think, in doctrine over the past several decades, how the courts have kind of abandoned their role in policing gerrymandering, policing districting. So if you go back 20, 30 years, the state courts in particular actively policed districting around what were called traditional districting principles, the idea that districts should be geographically compact, that all parts of a district should be contiguous. You should not have to leave the district to come back in the district, and that they should reflect communities of interest. These traditional districting principles are often embodied in many state constitutions and otherwise maybe in state common law in other states. And, you know, I think that gradually state courts kind of got a little of a view that maybe this was too political for them to intervene. They started to pull back. You know, the overlay of Voting Rights Act issues that kind of federalized a lot of the litigation. And you had the Supreme Court repeatedly tiptoe up to but ultimately back away from intervening in excessive political gerrymanders, most recently this past term in the Gill case, where the court refused to intervene in a crazy gerrymander in Wisconsin. And so you take all that, you add to it the rise of technology and the ability of really sophisticated mapping software to design perfectly gerrymandered districts, and you've turned the politicians loose with very little adult supervision on drawing these districts. And so you saw what you saw in Wisconsin. I alluded to that a second ago. In Wisconsin, the Democrats, Wisconsin, which is a 50-50 state, for one side to get 52 or 53% is like a gigantic win in Wisconsin. This year, the Democrats got 54% of the votes cast statewide for the state legislature and wound up with only 36% of the seats in the state legislature. That was quite an act of political engineering to make that happen in Wisconsin. An act of political engineering that this U.S. Supreme Court refused to get involved in. And, you know, I think that's a big flaw in our system again. Now, the good news I'd say on the redistricting front is that increasingly voters in both parties at the grassroots are rejecting this. And in many states, there have now been state initiatives to create nonpartisan redistricting commissions. And more states have pulled, by popular referendum, have pulled the power to district out of the legislatures and put it in some kind of districting commission. One last warning about that. That's a positive development. But I should say that the constitutionality of using those commissions was a question before the Supreme Court 3 years ago. The court upheld it only on a 5-4 vote, and Justice Kennedy was one of those five. And so now the question is, if this question comes back to the Supreme Court with Justice Kavanaugh in Kennedy's place, will this citizens' effort to control redistricting remain a viable option, or will the Supreme Court strike it down?
You talked a little bit about leaving some of these things to the political branches as producing potentially short-sighted results. But I'm sort of wondering, as you talk about gerrymandering, are some of those pursuing these short-term or short-sighted results actually thinking long-term? And do they have enough of a stranglehold on the levers of power in these states to, you know, suppress voting sufficiently, to gerrymander sufficiently to maintain that stranglehold?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, we have this obscure part of our Constitution that's never been, that the Supreme Court has repeatedly refused to use as a piece of doctrine, which is the guarantee clause, that we guarantee each state a Republican form of government. And at some point in time, you have to ask yourself, in Wisconsin, as a classic example, you know, what share of the vote should Democrats have to produce to control the state legislature? And at some point in time, if the Democrats, election after election, are producing more than half the votes and yet winding up in an extreme minority in the legislature, do you actually have Republican government in Wisconsin? Is it really a republic? I mean, I understand we're not talking about direct democracy. In a republic, sometimes the minority prevails. But over time, you would think that an electoral majority should be able to have political power, or else it's not even a republic. It's something else. And, you know, we're going to have to see how all this plays out in that way.
And you've been a Supreme Court clerk. You've helped confirm Supreme Court justices. You've paid very close attention to the Supreme Court. With its current makeup, is there any reason for optimism?
Well, not much, I suppose. Look, I think that we ought to see how Justice Kavanaugh rules in these matters. I mean, it's very interesting, and I do think that Brett Kavanaugh is a very partisan Republican and came up through the system as a very active Republican activist. But having been a judge in the District of Columbia, where there is no state and no districting, we don't really know what he's going to do on these redistricting cases. I'm not optimistic, but you never know. And so, I think it definitely, I know it will continue to be litigated, it will continue to be pursued, and we'll just have to see.
All right. Well, we're buying you dinner if Justice Kagan's First Amendment theory gets 5 votes.
I hear you.
All right, let's go the other direction then to post-election shenanigans. We've seen some pretty high-profile efforts lately in the lame duck period to reduce the powers of the governor in states where the party affiliation of the governor-elect is different. Are these efforts really a corrupt effort to subvert the will of the voters, or are they more legitimate and within the bounds of normal political constraints? And are there any historical precedents here? I mean, even going back to, say, Marbury versus Madison, how do we understand these current efforts that we've read about in the headlines?
Well, look, I think it goes to what I said at the outset, which is the spiraling downward effect between corrosion of democratic norms and the corrosion of the rule of law. So, you know, what we're seeing in North Carolina, to some extent in Michigan, Wisconsin, is an effort by the party that lost to use its remaining control before it leaves office to pass extraordinary legislation to alter the fundamental powers of different political institutions in that state. And that obviously reflects a disrespect for democracy. It leads to people doing things that that seem more and more outrageous, and there will be retaliation. And that retaliation is where again, I think you run risk of corroding the rule of law. Let's take a more high profile example, if you will, which is a decision by Senate Republicans back in 2016. Not to give a hearing to Merrick Garland to be confirmed to the Supreme Court, something that had happened in over a century. Merrick Garland, eminently qualified person, moderate. Republicans say, we're just going to break this norm. We're not going to give him a hearing. And, you know, Donald Trump becomes president. Neil Gorsuch takes his seat. Now we have Democrats talking about, maybe when we get back into power, we should take the Supreme Court from 9 to 11 and add 2 new justices. And we'll get it back that way. We'll just get a majority back by adding new justices. And, you know, maybe that's right, maybe that's wrong, right? But if the Democrats do that and they add 2 justices, then I suppose the next time the Republicans come in, even if there are 9 Democrats in the court, they'll just add 11 new justices. Well, 20 members in court. And then maybe the Democrats, they come back in, they add 20 new justices. And, you know, this just kind of goes on and on, right? And I take it that, you know, if the Democrats eventually get enough power in some of these states that now we're seeing this post-election shenanigans, will they do the same thing in return? Maybe they'll just pass a law that extends the governor's term by 4 extra years, notwithstanding the election results. I mean, so I think that the close relationship between our adherence to democratic norms and kind of the rule of law is at risk now. And if both sides don't do a better job of this, but particularly the Republicans don't do a better job of this, we're going to really see the Democrats retaliate. And where that ends, it's just hard to know.
Yeah. And obviously we saw in 2016, North Carolina, in the immediate aftermath of its election, passed some laws of a similar nature, and they were ultimately struck down by the court. Do you expect the laws in Wisconsin and Michigan to suffer a similar fate?
I hope so. You know, obviously one thing that's happening, we're talking about, the relationship between democratic norms and rule of law, is that with regard to the federal courts, President Trump is working very quickly and in some ways very irresponsibly to fill positions in the federal court. The federal appellate court, even though Trump's only been in office for 2 years and people serve for life, already 1 out of every 8 federal appellate court judges is a Trump appointee. By sometime next year, that'll probably be 1 in 6. And let's just be clear. Some of these people, you know, perfectly fine people and will do a good job as judges. But he set a record for the number of people rated not qualified by the ABA that he has nominated to the federal bench. He's setting a record for how young these people are. He set a record for how conservative these people are. And his appellate court nominees in particular, he's diverged wildly from prior Democratic and Republican presidents who largely named lower court judges, either from the state courts or from the federal district court, to the appellate court to name overwhelmingly the largest cadre of his people
are people from a private law practice who may, again, be more involved in politics, more, reflect more of a political view, have no background in judging at all. And so, you know, the ability of the courts to be a buffer against some of these anti-democratic acts may well be getting eroded by Trump's use of the appointment power and by the willingness of the Republican Senate thus far to essentially rubber stamp virtually all of these picks.
Let's make a bit of a shift here from talking about our own democratic processes and our administration of those processes to foreign influence or interference in our democratic process. At this point, Russian interference in the 2016 presidential election is pretty well established. With most folks. During that campaign, Donald Trump said that he could, quote, stand in the middle of Fifth Avenue and shoot somebody and, quote, not lose voters. Despite the many controversies that have ensnared the president, there are certain elements of his base that seem impenetrable. You almost get the sense that even as we learn more and more about Russian interference, many Trump supporters shrug their shoulders and say something along the lines of, I don't care, my guy won. Why is that not the right way to look at foreign interference in election, even if you get the result you want?
Well, I mean, look, I think that our country was founded on an ideal of democracy. And one thing that our founders were very concerned about was the risk of foreign interference in our democracy. And if you look at the history of the first 30 years of our republic, it's largely a lot of tension around whether or not the English or the French will wind up dominating the American political system, and a lot of work by the founding generation to make sure that neither would be the case and that Americans would decide our political fate. And, you know, when you become a country where other countries can willfully and recklessly interfere in your politics, you lose your sovereignty. You lose control over your own democracy. You become a proxy battle for foreign state actors. I mean, so in 2016, it was the Russians. If the Russians get away with it, who's to say that 2020, the Chinese won't get involved in our system and other countries, and we're just going to become, in essence, a foreign battleground where Americans aren't picking our leaders, but foreigners are heavily influencing the outcome of our elections, and we no longer control our own fate as a country. And look, I think that in what happened in 2016 is clearly that the Russians very skillfully exploited divisions in our society and used a combination of resources and technology to shape the electoral outcome in 2016. But, you know, Trump encouraged that. I mean, far from discouraging it, he encouraged it. We'll wait and see how much he actively helped plan it, how much he involved in conspiring with the Russians about it. But what we know was he stood on the campaign trail every day and said things like, hey, Russia, if you're listening, please steal Hillary's emails, or pointing out, calling attention to the Russian masterminded WikiLeaks releases 160 times between Labor Day and Election Day. And so when you have a participant welcoming that foreign involvement, exploiting that foreign involvement, potentially even conspiring to facilitate that foreign involvement, you have a substantial undermining of the idea that our democracy should be controlled by the American people.
Yeah. You know, if we transport ourselves back to 2016, a lot of people thought Donald Trump ran a pretty unorthodox political campaign, and many experts even thought he was ultimately going to lose. When we look at, for example, the Senate Intelligence Committee commissioned and recently released some pretty detailed reports on Russia's activities, you see there's a lot of commonality there. And they were both pursuing a similar strategy that was seemingly unorthodox and seemingly a losing one. Can we really expect that to be a coincidence, or do you anticipate to see some connection there?
Well, I think that either could be true, to be fair, which is that what I think both Trump and the Russians were doing was trying to delegitimize an anticipated Clinton presidency. And I think the Russians came to understand that helping Trump gain as much electoral traction as he could turning the American people against Secretary Clinton, that was in their interest, either because on a long shot prospect, Trump might win, but even if Clinton won, her win might be narrow. Large number of Americans might have thought her win was illegitimate, and she would have been hobbled as a president in confronting the Russians geopolitically because of a lack of public support. And so, you know, the way I think about it is the Russians shot for the moon and maybe got all the way to Mars, you know, in that they launched a program that I think they would have, you know, someone would have gotten a bonus in Russia, even if Clinton had won, for the ways in which these efforts would have made her win very, very narrow, would have made a lot of Americans question the legitimacy of her win, would have had her opponent questioning the legitimacy of her win, and that would have hobbled her as a president. And that would have been enough for the Russians, but they got the grand prize of actually their cohort, if not co-conspirator, in this actually prevailing. I think that in that way, Trump's campaign was not only unconventional, but obviously, you know, now we know in part illegal already. You know, we've had Michael Cohen plead guilty to campaign finance violations around the suppression of these stories of these two women who had affairs with the president on the eve of the stories being suppressed on the eve of the election. And then we still really don't know how much of we know also definitely criminal activity by the Russians. Again, we've seen again convictions or at least cooperation agreements and certainly indictments of various Russian affiliated people for illegally getting involved in American elections. And again, how much the Trump campaign was in that part of that, simply a happy collaborator with that, we just don't know.
Okay, Ron. So the very last question we're going to ask you, just so you know, is for a prediction about who's going to emerge out of the Democratic field. But before we jump to that exciting topic, you know, you've described a series of stressors on our electoral system through the lens of rule of law, both from foreign and domestic forces. What do you think we ought to be doing right now in anticipation of 2020 to strengthen the system against those kinds of foreign and domestic stressors?
Well, look, I really believe that the system is only as strong as the people choose to make it. And, you know, I think that 2018 is a good test case of this, in that President Trump did everything he could to try to subvert the will of the people. He lined himself with candidates like Brian Kemp and others to try to suborn or encourage all kinds of schemes of vote suppression and whatnot. He questioned the tallying of votes. He questioned the recount in Florida. And ultimately, the Democrats prevailed in most of these contests in 2018 because enough people came out and voted and produced a result that was substantial enough that these different things couldn't subvert that. And I really think in the end, that is the only remedy in 2020. That is, I really think the only way to ensure that Donald Trump is ousted, if that's what you want to see happen, that these forces are turned back, is to produce an outpouring of votes in opposition so substantial that none of the shenanigans and the tactics and the misdeeds can prevent that outcome from prevailing. And I wish there was a more institutional answer. I wish I could say, oh, we, you know, it's this lawsuit, or it's all signing this petition, or it's us all tweeting about the rule of law or whatever. But I think it's pretty clear that none of those things will work, and only an overwhelming electoral result can possibly prevail. And, you know, that's in some ways a lecture I took away from 2000. I think a lot of us who were involved in the 2000 campaign resolved not to see that happen again. And our answer to that in 2008 was to have Obama win by enough votes that, you know, we weren't caught in a recount in Florida in 2008. And I think a similar thing needs to happen now in 2020.
So win big.
Win big.
All right. And so who's it going to be? Is it going to be Joe Biden? Is it Beto? Who's going to be the Democratic candidate? Can you tell us what you think?
Well, I'm going to cop out a bit and say that you can't really predict who's going to win until you know who's running. And most of the people you mentioned haven't said if they're running or not. I have a great deal of affection for my former boss, Vice President Biden. If he runs, I'm behind him. And I think if he runs, I think he will prevail. But it's not clear to me if he's going to run or not. He hasn't made that decision. And until he does, it's hard to predict what happens. There are a lot of other great candidates out there. If he doesn't run, I'm sure the Democrats will find a really fantastic nominee to defeat Donald Trump. But I'm not going to predict who's going to win until these people decide who's running.
All right, fair enough. We're going to check back with you in a few months and see how we're doing. So anyway, Ron Klain, thank you very much for being with us on the Culper Partners Rule of Law podcast. It's been terrific.
Well, thanks for having me. I really enjoyed it.
The Lawfare podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. If you haven't yet, please share the Lawfare podcast on social media and give us a rating and review wherever you listen to us. The Lawfare podcast is edited by Jen Patya Howell, and our music is performed by Sophia Yan. And as always, thanks for listening.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.